Hello, welcome to the last lecture of this course, and the topic is radiation in X-ray laboratories. Okay. So where do we meet radiation in X-ray laboratories, and how this radiation is formed? So of course we have prompt radiation from the particle beam. So the beam itself gives us, if the beam hits us or anything, it will be like a particle radiation, and it's very very harmful, as people see. And beam induced radiation, so the beam hits something, inner parts of the accelerator, collimators, Faraday cups, wherever it hits, it will. Produce neutrons and gamma rays via nuclear reactions, and if the beam is electrons, then it induces synchrotron radiation. When the beam has hit some material and caused some nuclear reactions, it will activate the material. So so very often some radioactive isotopes are formed. The air can be activated. If the beam is taken out from the vacuum, the atmosphere, then it will activate air. And also neutrons, which are formed in nuclear reactions, they will activate also air. Many devices are cooled with water, and if the beam hits the water, it will of course activate it, but also the neutrons can activate the water. We have to have some safety precautions, so radiation protection, shielding, of course many other things. What would you suggest? One radiation protection is not to go to places where there is radiation. Very simple. We have to monitor the radiation level so that we know whether it's safe or not to go there. And these safety precautions, in addition to shielding, there are access restrictions so that we are not allowed to go in places where there might be radiation, and interlocks, so that if the radiation level increases a limit that we have set, like in areas where people can freely move, then if the radiation level dose rate increases above the threshold, then this interlock will switch off the beam, which causes the radiation. There are regulations. Radiation workers, if you have a class A radiation worker, then a 5-year floating average maximum is 20 millisieverts per year. So for example, if you get 100 millisieverts per year in 1 year, then for the 4 following years, you would not be allowed to work as a radiation worker. Actually, this 100 it already exceeds this limit here. So then it's something that shouldn't happen, but it may be an accident. But within the limits, using this 5-year floating average, so that altogether 100 millisieverts millisieverts in 5 years. In 1 year, you can get 50 millisieverts. So within the limits, if you get 50 millisieverts in two preceding years, then for the three following years, you are not allowed to work as a radiation worker. And then the general limit. So in our laboratory, it's for rooms with free access, so anybody can move there, is 0.5 microsieverts per hour. This extra radiation. Actually, the the natural background already is about 0.2 microsieverts per hour without the accelerator itself. So that's only from gamma rays, and we get most of the dose from alpha particles, that is radar. But we'll come down to these limits. That is somewhat okay. But this is the general limit that it includes the the background gamma rays, because we have in concrete we have radioactivity in ourselves as well. And then when the total reading exceeds 0.5 microsieverts per hour, then there should be an interlock to switch off the beam. Okay, let's look at what different kind of doses mean. Okay, 1 millisievert per year, that's limit for dose from food in the long term. If we double it, 2 millisievert altogether, that's a typical dose from Chernobyl in Finland during 50 years. So not very much, actually. Then 4 millisieverts per year. Actually, now it is three point something, but with three digits here, 4 millisievert per year. It's a typical dose in Finland. And in areas where radon may, in areas with a lot of radon, it will increase very, very much. So this is the average in whole Finland. This is what we get. Limit for food, short term, 5 millisievert per year. And now if we are radiation worker, this 5 year floating average 20 millisieverts and 50 for 1 year. That's the maximum dose for a radiation worker. Now we go to much, much higher doses. So here it was 0.05. We go up to 1.2 sievert. As a single dose, it may give radiation illness symptoms. But in the long term, typically, usually no symptoms at all. But if it's a single dose, 3 to 4 sieverts, then 50% will die within a few weeks if extensive medical aid is not given. So this is already severe, and this is lethal. 40 to 60 sievert in a single dose, our nervous system and digestive organs will be damaged quickly, and that's a quick death. But these are rather small values, and if you convert these to how many microsieverts per hour it is, then we can compare. This is our hourly limit. Okay, let's look at the units. Absorbed dose is gray. 1 gray is 1 joule per kilogram. And the dose rate is grays per second. However, depending on the radiation, the biological effect is different, even if the energy is the same per kilogram. So this dose equivalence, this is the absorbed dose in joules per kilogram, and then there's a quality factor Q, sometimes written as WR, and there's some other biological effects, but usually it's one, and this changes from radius to radius. So this is a quality factor Q or this WR. So photons at all energies is one. Electrons and muons at all energies is one. Okay, let's jump down here. Protons, other than recoil, protons or energy above 2 MeV, then it's already 5. And alpha particles, fission fragments, heavier nuclei, 20. And this difference can be understood easily. Can you? So these alpha particles, they have more charge in the nucleus than proton, and then heavy nucleus even more. And the effect for a living organism is the DNA chain. And then if one sort of ladder in this chain is broken, the DNA chain can repair itself. And if many steps of this ladder are broken, so the connections are broken, then the probability for the DNA chain to be damaged is bigger. And now if we have a particle that has more charge, then the density of these events is bigger, and it can break these DNA chains much more effectively, and the DNA chain cannot repair itself anymore. And now back to neutrons. Depending on the energy, at very, very low energy, neutrons factor is 5. And here, between 100 keV to 2 MeV, it's 20. And again, when the energy increases, then it goes down to 5. And the dose equivalent rate is then in sieverts per hour. An effective dose equivalent, then we have the weight for a specific tissue. So depending on the tissue, like nerves are more sensitive and so forth. And skin is not so sensitive as brains or heart, for example. This shows the stopping power, so how much energy per micrometer, for example, or so, is given to muscle. Then this proton has a maximum here at around 100 keV. And here it's 1 GeV. This is sort of backwards drawn Bragg peak picture, because when we come into the patient, for example, if we have radiation therapy at the skin, the energy is high, but there the dose or the energy deposit is lower, and then very close to its, when it's stopped at around 100 keV, when there's 100 keV left in the energy, then it gives most of the energy, and then when it stops, then it goes down. This is for protons. This is for alpha particles, so helium. Okay, and then gamma rays. This is a Chinese hamster ovary cell experiment. This is absorbed dose and survival probability. So one is maximum, of course. All the cells survive. And now, depending on the dose rate, we have different survival probabilities. So at low dose rate, which means that it takes a longer time to get this dose, the survival probability is bigger. So you can see that not only the dose matters, is only how fast you get it. So the dose rate, like in the previous table, it was this short term and long term effects. Okay, now let's look at the primary beam. The main rule is that never apply that to living organisms, except by purpose. So radiation therapy, where we kill tumor cells, sterilization. Well, this doesn't mean that we are sterilizing people. We are sterilizing medical equipment, like knives. Secondary radiation. So when the beam hits something, it will produce nuclear reactions, and then we get from there gamma rays and neutrons. But this dose rate decreases immediately when the beam is switched off, because these are the ones that come from the nuclear reactions. Of course, if we have residual activity, then we get gammas there and neutrons only if we have fission. And then to residual radiation. So this is what happens. Beam first hits the accelerator, beam tube, or other devices, and protons are that produce most of the activities. The reaction channels are PXN, so proton in and the number of neutrons out. And the number depends on the proton energy, of course. And this is one example. So we get cobalt isotopes from iron. Or secondary neutrons activate material. So we have first produced neutrons, and then we have neutron capture. For example, copper 63 plus neutron, we get copper 64, and about 13-hour half-life. Or iron isotopes from iron. And this is something that we really see in our cyclotron. So we have 15 tons of copper only in the main coils. And especially when we are accelerating protons, then we have a lot of neutrons, and the copper is activated. And after a proton run, when we have produced lots of neutrons, if you look at the radiation in the bunkers, cyclotron bunkers, the dose rate, then in the beginning, the half-life is of course shorter because we have short-lived activities, but when they have disappeared, then we have this 13-hour half-life for several days. And that comes from copper 64. This is a table that gives us principal radioactive isotopes, which are produced in accelerated structures by spallation reactions, and their gamma dose rate constants. So these are what we get here, for example. And so sodium 22 is not very nice. That we get, for example, from aluminium, when the proton hits the aluminium and the proton energy exceeds 30 MeV. That's the threshold energy. It's a rather nasty half-life, 2.6 years. And it's beta plus, so we can so that's a decay mode, and beta plus means always 2.511 keV gammas. In addition to some other gammas that may occur in the decay. So if the sodium 22 doesn't decay to the ground state, then there's nothing else than this. But if it decays also to the excited state, then we will have a gamma ray or something, depending on the energy. Okay. So these are good to know. And then this gives, when we measure the activity in becquerels, so it's femtosieverts per hour times the becquerels, multi measure, and this is at 1 meter distance from the source. Okay, what are the targets for the thermal neutrons? So, as I said, copper 63 in natural copper. We have lots of copper in accelerating structures when we have magnets. We have sodium in concrete, argon in air. There's always zinc in copper, manganese and cobalt in iron or steel, antimony in lead. And there are some trace quantities of manganese, cobalt, cesium, and europium in earth and concrete. This europium is quite interesting. We will see it in a minute. And there may be possibly tungsten, 186 in natural tungsten. So these are very, very good in as neutron capturers. Okay. And here's the list of those. So sodium, argon, calcium, krypton, manganese, and so forth. And here we have the europium, especially europium pump heat 1. And this here is the cross section of this neutron capture. So practically the probability. And if we, for example, take copper 63, there the cross section is 4.5 bar, but for europium, 8,700. It's really pretty huge. And half life here. So, so this is the active isotope half life 12 years. So we will always have neutrons, especially when we have light ions accelerated, like protons, deuterons, especially. Also, and then we will have neutron activation of a material. And this is what we get. Other aspects. So we must minimize the amount of material that can be activated. So don't use too thick pieces or devices or parts of devices. And this we noticed, for example, we have this spiral inflator that turns the beam from the axis to the median plane. And there we have the tantalum collimator, because it doesn't sputter as easily as copper or aluminium. So there's a tantalum plate with a hole through which the beam went. And in the earlier days, we changed the inflector manually, and we had to touch the the inflector, and we measured that the activity was very, very big. And we noticed that it was a tantalum collimator. And so we made it thinner, minimized the amount of tantalum there. And this also means that in the cyclotron bunker or in any place where we have lots of neutrons, don't leave any tools there. Don't leave any furniture there. Or if you do it, then don't take it out. So if you're doing some maintenance and you bring in some tools there in the bunker, carry it out when the work is done. A proper choice of materials. So that of course depends on the ions and their energies and cross sections for nuclear reactions. And this I already said before, so it is sodium 22. So if you have aluminium and proton energy less than 20, less than 30 MeV, sorry, there's a small V here, should be big. So then we could use aluminium tubes because then they are much better than iron when you think of the activation. But as in our K130 cyclotron, the proton energy can be much more than 30 MeV. And then it activates the aluminium tube. Of course, it activates the stainless steel tube as well. But in practice, this stainless steel tube in that case is better. You have to consider all the possible radiations there of what you get, what are the half-lives, what are the energies of gamma rays that you get. So then for our case, stainless steel tube was better choice than aluminium. Okay, and then the beam can hit water. And also neutrons can activate water. So this is a list of radioactive isotopes that are produced in air and water. So we have oxygen 14, 15, nitrogen 13, carbon 11, beryllium 7, tritium, argon 41. And if you look at the half-lives, 1.2 minutes, 2.1 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 53 days, 12.3 years, and around 2 hours. Tritium we produce very little, and not very much beryllium either, but this we produce more. And these are the cross sections from if the target is nitrogen or oxygen. Okay, but typically these, of course, these will be produced more because the shorter the half-life, the faster we can generate, we can get these isotopes. And these with the long half-life, it takes a very, very long time to produce them. And the good thing here is that so these are the typical activities in air or in water. And so when we switch off the cyclotron, then these will decay down. And also the pressure in the cyclotron bunker is less than outside. And there's a big ventilation, very fast ventilation, so the activity goes out, but it's very short-lived, so no danger for people outside. if we had some other nasty activities, then we should have some filtering. For example, if we are producing some radioactive isotopes, usually for medical purposes, then if we have some active gases there, then that must be stopped in filters and traps. If there's a release, accidentally release. Okay, about shielding then. The shielding should be as close to the source as possible, because the thickness of the shielding gives the rate of, so how much we can decrease the dose rate. And the further away it is from the source, the more material we need. So always as close to the source as possible. This is practical. And also distance helps. Don't go too close. So it goes as 1 over distance squared, very simply. And in rooms or caves, whatever, use chikans, or yeah, there's two ways of having an entrance to a cave. So either to have a very thick moving door, like we have this close to 3 meter thick concrete door sliding on rails, going on rails when we go into the cyclone bunker, or it can be an open corridor, but with chikans. So it has, the corridor has corners and bends, so that the radiation must have several reflections from the walls, and at each collision to the wall, only a very small fraction will continue. And this I already said. So lower pressure in rooms where air may be activated, and then so it's done by ventilation, and the ventilation takes the active air away. And luckily, most of the activities is very short-lived. We are talking about minutes. So then in our case, there's no danger outside. And for cooling circuit, if the water can be activated, then we must use a separate water cooling circuit for that, so that we don't first activate the water somewhere and let it circulate in the whole laboratory in the cooling circuit. So that's not very wise. So in those cases where the beam can directly hit the water, or there's a very, very high Newton flux, then this circuit must be separate. And the proper choice of materials and order of materials when we do the shielding. So when to use lead or iron and plastics, for example, for Newton shielding. So we must first thermalize the fast neutrons, and then stop the neutrons. After that, there are different materials for that. And always when you are designing a shielding, you must always assume the worst case when you are dimensioning the wall, floor, and ceiling thickness and materials. So, first of all, we are talking about the case when the whole beam is stopped somewhere. So, like we have a Faraday cup where the beam hits, where the whole beam is stopped. And what is the beam? If you don't have light ions, then the life is much easier. And depending on the energy and the intensity, if you have some hundreds of nanoamps, or if we have 100 microamps or up to milliamp beam, then it's totally different thing. And the thing that is our guiding line to the ceiling thickness is that the allowed dose rate outside the radiating rooms, they set the limit for radiation attenuation. So outside, the maximum allowed is 0.5 microsieverts per hour. In our cyclotron bunker, 2.5 meters of concrete would have been roughly okay, but we wanted to be on the safe side, so it's now 3 meters thick. And practically, we have never seen an increase of gamma dose rate outside the cyclotron bunker, no matter what the beam intensity and what the beam energy and particle has been. And we must monitor the dose rate. So already according to the safety license, you have to monitor radiation levels, so dose rates. So it's gamma and neutron monitoring. And there must be alarms when certain limits have been exceeded, and feedbacks and interlocks. so that the control system automatically will switch off the beam. The cyclone can be on, the RF, so the magnet can be on, the RF can be on, but if we don't have anything to accelerate, then we don't produce any more activity. So we don't switch off the cyclone when the limit goes off. We just stop the beam in the injection line so that there's nothing to accelerate. And we must monitor the doses. Class A radiation workers, it's in 4 week intervals when our dose meters are analyzed or read, depending on the type of monitor. And radiation B, class B radiation worker who get on the average, they get less dose, and the risk is much lower than for class A radiation workers, then it's 12 weeks intervals. Their dosimeters are analyzed. Sometimes we have to work in places where there's a clear risk of dose. So, for example, doing some maintenance for the cyclotron, which has lots of radioactive parts, then we must plan the work well, really well, to get it done quickly. And we cannot wait this 4 week interval, so we must have a separate meter dosimeter, so we can see the dose rate online, and then we can put there a limit, so that when this daily limit has been exceeded, it will give an alarm, and then that's the end of radiation work for that day. So safety first. And permissions. Before you can start running an accelerator, you need a safety license by radiation and nuclear safety authority. In Finland it's STUK, and every country has their own radiation and nuclear safety authority, but they are following the same guidelines which have been internationally set. All right, this was all about radiation. Think always safety first, and it's not so bad thing, but if you just have to know where the risky things are, and if you are moving in a controlled area, so areas, places where radiation is produced, then you must carry your own dosimeter. Okay, thank you for this lecture and for the whole course. This was the last video lecture.